Keep in mind, we haven't had an energy strategy in this country for over a decade. The Social Security issue hasn't been on the table since 1983. I mean, seriously on the table. And so I'm asking Congress to do some difficult things. And I'm going to keep asking them to do some difficult things. And I'm optimistic when it's all said and done that we will have come together and have helped solve some of these significant problems.
You worry that you're losing some of your push?
I don't worry about anything here in Washington, D.C. I mean, I feel comfortable in my role as the president, and my role in the president is to push for reform. The American people appreciate a president who sees a problem and is willing to put it on the table. Listen, admittedly, I could have taken the easy route and said, let's don't discuss Social Security until somebody else shows up in Washington. But that's not what the American people want from their president. And we have a serious problem in Social Security. I thought you asked about the Social Security issue, and I reminded her that the attitude is beginning to shift here in Washington, because for a while, people here said it really wasn't a significant problem, and I wish he hadn't have brought it up. And now people are beginning to see the realities of Social Security and the fact that we're about to pass on a huge burden to a young generation of Americans. A burden, by the way, which doesn't have to be passed on. We can permanently solve Social Security and should permanently solve it. And I've laid out some initiatives to get us on the way to permanently solving Social Security. I look forward to the day of sitting down with Republicans and Democrats and congratulating both political parties on doing what's right for the American people. A day, by the way, the American people expect to come as well. Vandehei.
You've been listening to live coverage from Washington of a press conference by President Bush. This is AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. On the show today, we have a couple of programs dealing with American history from the archives, both of them from last year. In the first hour, a conversation about the War of 1812. So as you listen, do keep in mind this is an archive program, and this morning on Focus, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of the program, we will be dipping back into American history and talking about a war, one of America's wars, that went a long way toward making America the place that it is. However, at the same time, it's one that just doesn't have the place in the American imagination that other American wars do, particularly the Revolution and the Civil War. And the war that we're talking about is the War of 1812. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Walter Borneman. He is the author of a number of books on Western history, including one about the state of Alaska. He also is the author of a new book that is titled 1812, The War That Forged a Nation. And it's published by HarperCollins. And if you say at the outset that you would have to admit you don't know a lot about the War of 1812, as I would have had to admit before looking at the book, and if you're interested in learning, this is a good place to go. And it is really a fascinating story. And the author, as I'm sure he will on the show here this morning, makes the argument that indeed that the War of 1812 was very important, went a long way to having people who lived various places around the new United States feel that indeed they were one nation. Mr. Borneman, hello.
Good morning, David. Good to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Perhaps a place to start as a way of setting the stage would be to ask you to talk a little bit about what the United States was like in the early 1800s.
We know the United States is really still a pretty loosely confederated union of 18 different states. You know, there we've got the 13 original colonies, and Kentucky and Tennessee have joined the Union. Most recently, in 1803, Ohio becomes the 17th state. And then we jump all the way over to Louisiana, which is actually admitted in 1812. But, you know, all of these states are still pretty loosely confederated. New England is interested in its own things. There's folks in the western states who are looking across the Mississippi River and wanting to move westward. But there's really not the sense of national identity or national union that I think some contemporary observers said that existed for a while after the American Revolution. But some of that it had sort of all been taken over again by those regional interests.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we go on then to ask the basic questions about, well, why is it that the United States decided to declare war on Britain, there were several things, and you say in the book that any of these things by themselves perhaps would not have been enough for the war to be declared, but taken together there were, and they perhaps also reflect the fact that people at different parts of the country had different sorts of concerns. One main area of concern had to do with American shipping. And what was going on at the time, because this also, after all, was the time of the Napoleonic War. So at the time, Britain was fighting a war with France. So they were at war on that front. But that also spilled over and had an effect on the United States, even though technically the United States in that conflict was supposed to be neutral.
Well, that's true. And in many respects, the United States was sort of caught in the middle between France and Great Britain, who, as you say, were battling through the Napoleonic Wars. And, of course, what Great Britain really needed was sailors for its navy. Its navy was the lifeblood, not only to defend the island, but to defend its shipping and commerce around the world. And Great Britain had long established a system of impressment. That basically meant that the Royal Navy could stop other ships of flying the British flag, their commercial ships, and impress or take sailors off of those commercial ships and force them to serve in the Royal Navy. Now, that at least was going with their own shipping, but Great Britain also took that system of impressment and put it against other neutral flags and put it against the United States. So what would happen is the Royal Navy would stop American ships, and just about anyone who had a glimmer of British blood in their veins was impressed, or people at that point said almost kidnapped, off of American ships and forced to serve in the British Navy. So this was really a degrading practice and something that caused many people in the United States to be up in arms. The other part of that, which is sort of part and parcel to the impressment issue for going to war, was that as the United States was trying to trade with Great Britain, France would come along and seize American ships. As the United States was trying to trade with France, Great Britain would do the same. And actually, at one point, David, in the year or two before the war, France had seized more American ships than Great Britain had. And there were some in Congress who suggested in the debate leading up to this declaration of war, some in Congress suggested that the United States ought to issue letters of marque and reprisal, basically legalizing privateers, against both Great Britain and France. So there's no really cut and dried attack on Pearl Harbor, for example, that gets the United States to declare war. But all of these issues that are a little bit convoluted, and as you suggest, certainly not, there's not unanimous agreement in the different regions of the United States. New England, quite frankly, looks on some of this and says, well, yeah, we're losing a few sailors, and yeah, we're losing a few ships. But, you know, it's kind of a cost of doing business, because if we go to war, then, my goodness, the British Navy is probably going to come over here and wreak even greater havoc, put a blockade along the East Coast and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's another set of issues and interests that have to do with what at that time would have been considered the West, which is still at the time we're talking about land that actually is east of the Mississippi, territory that later on would become places like Indiana. That at that time, I think the furthest westernmost states in the United States were probably Kentucky and Tennessee. And there was this area that people were interested in expanding into. There again, there were a couple of things that Americans believed that the British were stirring up the indigenous people, Native Americans, Indians, whatever word you want to use, against them. So that was yet another reason for animosity against the British. And also, interestingly enough, there were some people in that region had for some time been looking at Canada and been thinking about the fact that they'd like to invade. And all of that kind of came together at adding, again, some momentum towards the declaration of war against Britain.
Well, that's definitely true. Let's talk about Canada first as of those two issues. You know, Henry Clay from Kentucky is elected to the House of Representatives in 1810, and almost his single point is that the United States should invade Canada and Canada should become part of the United States. Now, this isn't a particularly new notion, because as early as the Revolution in 1775, Benedict Arnold, before he becomes a traitor, leads an American force to the gates of Quebec and makes an attempt to capture Canada. That fails, but there's still a lot of folks, particularly those in the states of New York and this new crowd of Westerners at that point, which, as you suggest, are filling in Kentucky and Tennessee and what will become the states of Northwest Territory. There's folks in that crowd, led by Henry Clay, who still desperately want Canada to become part of the United States. It's sort of manifest destiny. That term hasn't been coined yet, but that's certainly the mentality. And Henry Clay and his war hawks, who are basically senators and congressmen from mostly the western states, although that includes Georgia, and it also includes people like Peter Porter from New York, his cronies, the War Hawks, really, really push this acquisition of Canada and push the declaration of war as a means to accomplish that. That, by the way, really infuriates some of the Federalists who are in New England and are in the opposing party by and large, who again see this war not as anything to do with the issues that they might have on the high seas, impressment and the seizure of ships, but just this lust for territory by Clay and his warhawks. Now, let me just touch briefly on the second part of that issue related to Native Americans. A lot of people thought that the British, particularly in along the Great Lakes and again in the area of Illinois and Indiana, those even Western Ohio at this point, those states that are going to be formed out of the Northwest Territory and beginning in 1812, there's only Ohio that's been admitted to the Union so far. But there are a lot of people on the frontier who are moving west, Americans, who are just sure that the British are using their contacts, mostly trading contacts with the Native Americans, to incite them to attack the American settlers and inflame the border. Of course, there are others on the British side who are just as sure that that's American policy to do that. And probably the truth of the matter is that there was some on both sides, but the bottom line is really just there's a clash of two cultures, Native American cultures versus the Anglo culture that's trying to move into lands in Indiana. And, of course, where this comes to a head, really, is with the Battle of Tippecanoe in 1811, which, while it's prior to the declaration of war, is still the event that one might say on the western frontier is the beginning of the War of 1812.
We have a caller here. Others who were listening would be welcome to call with questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller is in Belgium, nearby community. Line number 4, hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. In your last statement, you just got exactly to the question I was going to ask. Benjamin Harris walked up from, I think, Terre Haute to essentially Lafayette, Indiana, to fight the Battle of Tippecanoe. And I was going to ask if that wasn't actually the very first rounds of the War of 1812 in that aspect. But it sounds like you already answered and said, yes, it probably was just about the beginning of the war.
Well, I think it definitely is on the western frontier. It's William Henry Harrison, actually.
Exactly.
There's some Benjamin Harrisons thrown in the line, and of course, Benjamin Harrison, the most famous Benjamin Harrison, is probably William Henry's grandson, who becomes president later on. But William Henry Harrison did go forth to the Battle of Tippecanoe, and I would indeed say that was the beginning of the War of 1812 in the West.
Yes, because there are areas along here where you can still see the trace of the tracks that his wagons and stuff traveled up, because that was one of the real early trails that people walked along the Wabash River.
That's true, and he moved with a fairly large force for that time and moved very slowly and very deliberately, setting up some relatively elaborate camps. And a lot of folks criticized him for the camp that he made at Tippecanoe because some of his political enemies later on thought that he'd sort of been suckered in there by the Shawnee and other Native Americans. But, of course, the truth of the matter is that he set up a very strong defensive perimeter, and when the assembled Native Americans attacked, they were repulsed, and he went on the next day to basically burn Prophetstown.
Is Fort Wiantanon, which is in, I think, West Lafayette, was that one of his campsites?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I don't know about that.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks.
You're welcome.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me, as I said in the beginning, about the fact that I think in a lot of people's minds that 1812, War of 1812, does not have the place that the Revolution does and certainly the Civil War does. And yet, when you look at the list of names of individuals who were involved in this war, they certainly are names that resonate with people because we are talking about men who, for example, went on to become president, like William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor and Andrew Jackson, and then people who are great military heroes like Stephen Decatur and Oliver Perry. And, you know, the list seems to go on and on of people that are familiar names who are important for their involvement in the war. And yet somehow it still seems that we don't have much of a sense of this war or what it was about.
One of the things that this war did was sort of provide a testing ground for a new generation of American military leaders. And one of the reasons I think that there are some bumbles and stumbles in the beginning with the American military, not only are they underfunded, underprepared, but they're really almost undergeneraled, because there's the general officers are the old generation left over from the Revolution. Boy, they've served valiantly in the Revolution, and they've done their patriotic service, but they're really past their prime. And what that means is there's sort of a leadership vacuum. But once that vacuum begins to get filled, there are people not only like William Henry Harrison and some of the naval heroes that you mentioned, but also like Winfield Scott, who starts out as a young colonel and commands an artillery regiment in the Niagara campaigns, goes on to fight in the major battle there of Lundy's Lane. And, of course, Scott will come out of the war a major general and then be the man who not only is involved in the Mexican War leading American troops, but is still in command of the American Army at the beginning of the Civil War 40 years later. I mean, it's an amazing career that really begins in the War of 1812. And there are others like that. Zachary Taylor is a young captain who, again, is fighting on the Western frontier, and he emerges from the war, stays in the military, fights in the Mexican War, and of course, becomes president.
The other thing that's noteworthy, and in a sense we've touched on it, is how poorly prepared the United States military was, and how much smaller certainly it was when you take a look at the resources that the British had. Even though at the time, initially when the war started, they were tied up with dealing with Napoleon. But it takes quite a bit of nerve when you think about a country with military resources of the United States taking on Britain. It even ladles on more nerve when you think about those moments when there are some people who thought that the United States should take on both Britain and France.
That's true, and I think one of the reasons perhaps for that is sort of mirrors this division that's in the country. A lot of people just thought, oh, yeah, there's some problems, but there's no way that we're really going to go to war. President Madison sent his declaration of war to Congress very reluctantly, and after Congress debated it, this is the closest vote for war in American history. And after they finally voted for war, and the Senate only agreed to it by a vote of 19-13, which is very narrow considering later votes in American history, I think there are a lot of people, including President Madison, who thought, okay, you know, now we've gotten Great Britain's attention. They're going to stop seizing ships. They're going to stop this issue of impressment. And this thing will be over in 6 months, and maybe if we're lucky, we will have gotten Western Canada. But there's not going to be any major land operations. I think a lot of people thought that, and I think that's one of the reasons that they didn't give a lot of thought to, oh my gosh, how can we declare war and basically only have an army that was numbering in the thousands? Henry Clay had made the boast that the militia of Kentucky alone was sufficient to conquer Canada, but as the history of the war would prove, that was a boast that certainly was overrated and never came to pass.
Yeah, one of the things that you write about in the book is when this was being discussed in Congress, that indeed it did pass that first pass the House, but that there were people in the House that were hoping that the Senate wouldn't approve it.
Exactly. I think the phrase I use is people hoping that they would the Senate would save the country from the votes in the House. And, you know, there was this sort of crescendo, particularly in the House, of the war hawks and Henry Clay fanning the fire, saying, boy, we've got to do this. And the Senate, quite reluctantly on some people's parts, they did vote to do it, but there, I tell the story in the book about Stephen Bradley from Vermont, who almost certainly would have been a no vote, and sort of as the Senate is debating this, there's this coach carrying Bradley just almost racing its way south, and each day he gets a day closer to Washington, but each day the Senate is a day closer to voting for war, and he finally arrives a couple days later after the vote.
We're almost at our midpoint here. We have some other calls we'll take. Perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Walter Borneman. He's the author of a number of books on Western history, one about Alaska with a long subtitle, that is, Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land from Russian Fur Traders to the Gold Rush, Extraordinary Railroads, World War II, the Oil Boom, and the Fight Over Anwar. So if you're interested in reading about Alaska, you can look at that book, and I think it's just came out last year. And a new book that's all about the War of 1812, which is titled 1812, The War That Forged a Nation, published by HarperCollins. And again, to callers, or back to callers, next is in Buckley, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I want to clarify one thing. When you mentioned Canada, most of the people in the States will think of Canada today. Actually, it was only a upper and lower Canada was a province of Ontario, southern Ontario, and Quebec. My question is, why didn't the Americans try to make an alliance with the French, who were very discontented with the British at the time, in order to expel the British from North America? Thanks.
Well, you're correct about Upper and Lower Canada. Upper Canada at that point is basically Ontario. Lower Canada is Quebec. I think one of the reasons, the major reason, is that the United States had some grievances against France, too, because, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, France was seizing even more ships 1 year than the British had done. And, you know, even though France, through Napoleon, had turned around and sold the Louisiana Territory to the United States, there were a lot of people in the United States, even Thomas Jefferson, who kind of looked askance at France and wondered what Napoleon was really up to. And while the United States was nominally neutral in the war between Great Britain and France, I think that there were many in the United States who thought, well, gosh, if Great Britain doesn't prevail, and Napoleon really does prevail, is he going to be back in New Orleans and trying to take back Louisiana and some parts of the western United States?
Okay. Actually, my question is about Quebec and the fact that the French colonists in Quebec were deserted by France, and therefore should have some animosity against the British, who were anti-Catholic, and their rule in Quebec. And the Americans could have forged an alliance with them that would have isolated the loyalists and the British in Canada and in that part.
Well, many people thought that both the French Canadians in Quebec and more of the people in Ontario, who some of them had some roots in the United States, would actually rise up and welcome the Americans as liberators rather than invaders. Well, that did not happen. It did not happen in the West by Detroit. It did not happen south of Montreal and Quebec. Rather, there were Canadian militia units that served side by side by regulars in the British Army and really work to repel the American invasion. So for whatever historic reason, with feeling deserted by France and everything else, there's by 1812 perhaps a feeling that Quebec wants to have thrown off the yoke of Great Britain, but not to have traded it for any kind of relationship with the United States.
All right, thank you very much.
Very good. Let's go to Indiana for another caller on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello. Two general questions. First question deals with the impressment. I start vaguely remembering, you know, back history classes, at least in high school. Can you give some just general views of, you know, I just find that sort of unusual that that a capitalist society would go out and, you know, sort of hinder capitalism by taking away its workers, so in a real broad, you know, broad strokes. And I was wondering if you could say something about that. And second,
well, I'd be glad to, and then I'll get to your second question. But I think the reason is that the Royal Navy was so important that if the Royal Navy was not there to protect the island and to protect the commerce, then there wouldn't be any commerce anyway. And the impressment issue is so solidly ingrained in the British psyche at that point that the British never even discuss it at the Treaty of Ghent. And when the British peace commissioners finally sit down with the Americans, they won't even talk about this. It's a non-negotiable. They think of it almost as some kind of inalienable right to stop ships, not only their own merchantmen, as we discussed, but also other neutral countries to seize, again, let's say British, although they might only have a drop of British blood in their veins, to seize British sailors to serve in the Royal Navy. It's just that important to them. What was your second question?
Second question deals broadly with diplomatic history.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about all these hawks that ended up being presidents. What sort of things happened on the diplomatic front that, in a sense, influenced the growth of the country? Thank you.
Well, I think diplomatically, the biggest thing to really come out of the War of 1812, and I'll tell you a little story about John Quincy Adams, who certainly was not a war hawk and came to the presidency in 1824, but he is cutting his teeth again, a younger generation coming up. His father's been president. He's sent him to several diplomatic posts around the world. And in the fall of 1814, John Quincy Adams is one of the American peace commissioners in Ghent, Belgium, waiting for the British to show up. And I say waiting for the British to show up because the British, by that point, were really dragging their heels. They thought that they could score some territorial gains in the United States. And John Quincy Adams is almost wringing his hands, writing letters back home saying, oh, I can't understand why we're having to wait so long, and, you know, every day might bring news that there's been some disaster in some part of the United States, some territorial gains by the British. So John Quincy Adams at the Treaty of Ghent is almost just sort of sitting there with his hat in his hand. Well, fast forward, and this is my point, fast forward a dozen years or so afterwards, and suddenly John Quincy Adams is now James Monroe's Secretary of State, and it's John Quincy Adams who sort of puts forth what becomes the twin cornerstones of the Monroe Doctrine. And those say to Russia and other countries, no more colonization attempts in North America. And, oh, by the way, the second piece of that, the non-intervention piece, is keep your hands off Europe, any of the new governments that have sprung up in your former countries in Latin America. Well, this decade from 1814, when John Quincy Adams is sort of sitting there as the poor nephew waiting for the mighty British Empire to sit down and negotiate with the Americans, a dozen years later, to where, as Secretary of State, he can basically issue this doctrine and say, by golly, the United States is going to take care of not only North America, but the Western Hemisphere. I think that diplomatically is a gigantic leap forward, and it really says a lot about the United States coming of age during that decade.
Let us go again to another caller, and this will be someone in Chicago, line two. Hello.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
As to the impetus and the people pushing for the War 1812, in Kevin Phillips' book, The History of the Super Rich, he states a statistic at one point that 60% of the liquid capital in the United States at the time of the Revolution had been gotten through piracy, and that these, quote, merchants who were gaining a lot of wealth this way were one of the groups that was most strongly pushing for a war, and that people that live further from the coast and weren't benefiting from this as much were the ones more opposed to it. I wonder if that goes along with your thinking.
Well, actually, from what my research has shown, and a lot of the things that I come up with in the book would suggest that that's really not true as far as New England. Now, New England was certainly pushing its commerce, pushing its maritime interests, but, you know, and it's not black and white, because there are people in New England who do, in fact, vote to go to war. But the majority of people in the New England area and in New Jersey and Maryland, the mid-Atlantic states, who are engaged more in a trading economy, I think that they really looked at the war as something that was going to disrupt things. And again, it was a little different. It wasn't like every ship was seized. It was still only a relatively small percentage of the ships that were out there. And again, as to the issue of impressed sailors, there were thousands, but, you know, not tens of thousands, and there weren't crews being stripped 100%, that sort of thing. So I guess my point is that on both of those issues, those who were engaged, at least from my view and what I've read, those who were engaged in commerce, the majority of them really saw the war as a problem and something that was going to be a negative rather than a positive, where these things that some people were saying, hey, we have to go to war over, were really, again, more of a cost of doing business.
Did I get at your question?
Thank you.
Go on. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
The war was fought both on the land and on the water. And the United States really had its few, it didn't have much success anywhere, but what success it had was on the water, was on the Atlantic, and was also in the Great Lakes. Things did not go so well in the land battle. As we talked a little bit earlier, there were people in the western part of the United States and what was the Northwest Territory, sort of around this part of the country, who had their eyes on Canada and had this idea that, well, there we should simply just be able to walk in. There weren't that many Canadians, and there was, as you explained, the expectation. Some people had the expectations that some Canadians would look on the Americans as liberators and would not fight for the British. And that turned out not to be true. And generally speaking, the military part of this that was fought on land in that part of the United States was pretty much a disaster for the United States.
I think that's really true. There's 3 years of invasion attempts all along the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River to invade Canada, and all of them really fail. There are battles in 1812, 13, and 14 all along the Niagara River. One of them, the biggest, Lundy's Lane, is fought almost within earshot of Niagara Falls. Their invasion attempts from Detroit, and even when William Henry Harrison wins a fairly major victory at the Battle of the Thames in western Ontario, just a little bit east of Detroit in 1813, that victory is really not followed up. They've chased the British out of Detroit, recaptured Detroit, as it were, but they really haven't taken over and been able to hold a lot of Canadian territory. Same thing happens lower down on the St. Lawrence River. There are invasion attempts to get at Montreal, which fail. Might mention quickly the capital of Upper Canada at that point is a place called York. We know it today as Toronto. And in 1813, a British an American expedition sailed across Lake Ontario to attack York. And basically what happened in a nutshell is that either by order or by accident, many different stories to how it happened, the government buildings at York, pretty small buildings, but nonetheless the capital buildings of Upper Canada, were burned. And this set up a series of reprisals along the border. The Canadians and British went back a few months later and burned Buffalo. Americans retaliated by going across Lake Erie and burning a place called Long Point. And, of course, that escalates until by the fall of 1814, when the British fleet appears in Chesapeake Bay, the British admiral is determined to really get some measure of retaliation, and that's what leads to the raid on Washington and the burning of the government buildings there.
Yeah, that's probably one of the, if people know anything about the War of 1812, that's going to be one of the things they can tell you, was that this was the war in which the British invaded Washington, D.C., and burned the White House and burned the Capitol building.
Yes, and then, of course, moved on to Baltimore, and we all know the story of the national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, being written with the defense of Fort McHenry.
Mm-hmm. Which was a successful defense.
Yes, that's correct.
What happened in Washington, D.C. that turned it into such a rout, I guess you would have to say?
Well, I think that there are two parts of that, why Washington is such a rout. One is, I don't think that, and this speaks to the issue of national identity and national capital, I don't think that there were many people who really thought the British were going to come to Washington, because in their own minds, they really didn't value it as a national capital. If they'd been attacking Richmond or New York City or Boston, I think that might have gotten a lot more attention. But Washington itself, very small city at that point, and it's only been the national capital for less than 15 years or so. And again, there's no sense really of importance. The second part of that really goes back to the military answer, that at that point there are relatively unprepared militia units around Washington, and there's a sort of a debate as to whether or not they ought to try to defend Washington or whether there's going to be a defense of Baltimore. A lot of the regular army is out on the Niagara frontier and is also out on the Lake Champlain frontier. So those militia units that really do come together and come up with a strong defense are all gathered around Baltimore, because Baltimore is the commercial hub of the Chesapeake. It's the third largest city in the country at that point. And, you know, it's really considered an economic prize. No one really thinks that Washington is of much value, and even though there are militia units, the battle's called the Battle of Bladensburg, that meet the British advance, they hold for a couple of advances, a couple of lines hold, and then finally, or a couple of lines are formed, and then are defeated and retreat, and finally there's a general rout back to Washington, and the British march into Washington almost unopposed.
Mm-hmm. The United States did manage to have some success on the water. It may be, as far as its contribution to the overall war, not much. It did, however, boost American morale. There were the actions involving the Constitution, Old Ironsides, and there was this famous battle fought in Lake Erie by Oliver Perry. This is the one, and I don't know if people know this story, but it's, again, one of these sort of famous stories that has come down to us, that his flagship was damaged, too damaged to fight, and so he actually left his flagship in a rowboat, one of the small boats that these ships would have had, and rowed over to another ship, took that ship, took over command, and ultimately won, beat the British, and became a national hero in the process.
Yes, I think the sea battles that occur out in the Atlantic between the frigates, the Constitution that you mentioned gets its name, Old Ironsides, from its first encounter there with the HMS Guerriere, and it sends the British frigate to the bottom, and in the grand strategy of things, it's not much of much importance. But my goodness, the British Navy is not used to losing frigates, and when the Constitution does that again with the Java, and when the United States, under Stephen Decatur, who you mentioned, does that as well to the Macedonian, all in the sight of 3 or 4 months, the British Navy is saying, wait a minute, what is going on here? And there's a big hue and cry among the British public to put more pressure on the United States. Well, again, Great Britain is locked in the struggle with Napoleon, but because of these defeats, the British Admiralty really decides that even though resources are stretched thin in Europe, it must dispatch more ships to North America, which it does, and it begins a process of tightening the blockade. And the glories of the Constitution and the United States that occur in the first year or so of the war are not repeated because, by and large, after their victories, they sit bottled up in East Coast ports because of the tightening British blockade. Now, even more fascinating, I think, to me than those frigate battles on the Atlantic are what you mentioned, not only in terms of Lake Erie, David, and Oliver Hazard Perry with his battle flag saying, don't give up the ship, rowing across to the brig Niagara to continue the fight. But there's another battle that occurs on one of North America's lakes, Lake Champlain. And I think that if we know about the War of 1812, we may well know something at least about the Battle of Lake Erie. But almost no one has heard about the Battle of Lake Champlain. The point is that when the British are marching on Washington, burning Washington, attacking Baltimore, this is to be really just sort of a retaliatory raid and a diversion, if you will, from the main British invasion force, which is marching south from Montreal up the Lake Champlain Valley into upstate New York. Well, again, we don't hear much about that. We hear about Fort McHenry, and what happens on Lake Champlain as this British army, incidentally, three times the number that are in operating in the Chesapeake, as that British army is moving south, the Americans defeat the small British naval flotilla on Lake Champlain and get naval superiority on the lake, threaten the flanks of the British army, and the British army turns around and retreats.
Mm-hmm. By the time we get around to the end of the war, and near the end of 1814 with the Treaty of Ghent, you can understand why it is the United States would like to be done with this. First of all, because it has not been a particularly popular war. It has not led to a great deal of military success by the United States. There was the difficulties with the crimp it's put in trade. So American business people didn't like it terribly much. So I guess you could see why the United States, why some people in the United States would like to see this war end, even though it hasn't seemed to be going particularly well in favor of the United States. What was it that, I mean, you talk about that, but also about what was it that finally led the British to say, or as far as they were concerned, they wanted to stop too?
Well, I think the Americans are tired out by the fall of 1814. They've been trying to negotiate and get the British to sit down with them for the better part of the year. Their economy is in shambles. They haven't made any territorial acquisitions in Canada. And yeah, there have been a few battles to cheer about, but by and large, it's been pretty bleak militarily, and certainly economically, it's almost a disaster. What happens in Europe is that in the fall of 1813, Great Britain and its European allies have defeated Napoleon for the first time and sent him off to exile at Elba. And they've been able to put more British troops and more British ships into action in North America and do the things that we've just talked about, not only at Lake Champlain, but in the Chesapeake Bay area during the course of 1814. Well, they realize that there hasn't been any quick victory, and they're kind of looking around thinking, okay, how do we get out of this? So the bottom line is that even though Great Britain will never yield on this issue of impressment, the bottom line is that in the fall of 1814, by Christmas of 1814, the American and British peace commissioners at Ghent have basically agreed to adopt a status quo peace treaty where everything that was in place at the beginning in 1812 is in place at the end. And that's the peace treaty that is dispatched across the Atlantic for the American Congress to decide in the opening months of 1815. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they jump on it very quickly and ratify it.
And I guess having spent some time here talking about the lack of military success by the United States, we should not neglect to talk about the Battle of New Orleans, which is and probably the other thing next to the burning of the Capitol that people will know about the War of 1812, which was a significant American victory. And, of course, interestingly enough, actually, when the battle took place, the war was over.
That's true. By the time that the peace treaty had been signed and the news of it had not reached the American capital yet, but by the time that it did, this battle at New Orleans had been fought. The British Army and the British Navy that are in Chesapeake Bay have sailed around the Floridas, sort of made a feint at Mobile, landed outside of New Orleans in December of 1814 to advance on that city. And, of course, Andrew Jackson, Frontier General Old Hickory, has put together a collection of some Army regulars, bayou pirates, backwoods militia, and stands on the plain at Chalmette, a few miles from New Orleans, and basically defeats a massive British frontal attack in January of 1815. And out of this, I think, come two things out of the Battle of New Orleans. One, Jackson and his army, loosely a very loose and diverse army of different backgrounds, really stands united. And Jackson even says to them after the battle has been fought and won, you know, you came here from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different cultures, but you stood today united as Americans. And I think those words of Jackson after the Battle of New Orleans then went on to resonate around the entire country. And, of course, Jackson eventually goes on to the presidency. But in kind of a little what if, remember that we just said that the Treaty of Ghent had called for a return to the status quo. Great Britain had never recognized the sale of Louisiana Territory by France to the United States. Indeed, it had never really recognized how France had gotten the territory to sell it away from Britain's Spanish ally. So if Great Britain had in fact prevailed at New Orleans, it's quite possible they would have said, well, yes, we signed the Treaty of Ghent, but that's called for a return to the status quo. We're now in occupation of New Orleans, and we're going to put things back the way we think the world order should be and return the Louisiana Territory to Spain. You know, if that had happened, there would have been some major restrictions on America's ability to move westward.
Mm-hmm. Given the fact that, again, sort of going back to the fact that when they sat down to the table to sign the treaty that would end the war, that the United States, it was unpopular. The country was tired of it. It had been economically difficult. It wasn't a lot of military success. Given all of that, it seemed that it wasn't very long before this war passed into the popular imagination of Americans, at least for a while, as having been a victory. That is, that people thought we won. And when you take a look at what things looked like there at the end of the war in 1814, you have to ask the question, did the United States win? Or you might well ask the question, did anybody win?
I think the question, did anybody win, is probably certainly the British and Americans did not win. I think that they just went back to, militarily, they just went back to the status quo. If there was a winner, again, it's this sense of national identity, because suddenly everybody is ready to remember the glories of Old Ironsides or quote, don't give up the ship, and remember a few proud moments, including, of course, Jackson's great victory at New Orleans. But beyond that, all of the dissension, the close vote, the fact that even as late as December 1814, there are people in New England who simply want to secede from the Union and not be part of James Madison's continuing war efforts. I think from that standpoint, you know, there are no victors. If there's a real loser in this, it's the Native Americans, not only the Native Americans in the Northwest who have been pushed out after the Battle of Tippecanoe, and also Native Americans in Alabama and the Deep South, where Andrew Jackson has basically fought the Creek War. You know, the British in the Treaty of Ghent in calling for this return to status quo, put in there an article that says, we're going to return all of the Native American lands to their status as they were at the beginning of the war. Well, I think whether that was noble on their part or whether that was just window dressing or whether that was just a hope that some way they could continue to hem in the United States a little bit, the truth of the matter is, of course, is that no one was going to be able to repeal or revoke the territorial gains and the rush of settlers that flowed not only into the Northwest territories in the states of Indiana and Illinois, but also into the Deep South in Alabama and Mississippi. And you only have to look at the entrance admittance of states to the Union after the war. Very quickly, the states of Indiana and Illinois, Alabama and Mississippi all joined the Union.
And I think and also not very long after that, Florida also.
Yes, Florida takes a little while longer. But certainly it becomes a territory because of Andrew Jackson's continuing push down there.
So in a sense, you have already answered this question, but as I began asking the question about having you talk a little bit about what America was like in the early 1800s. So now, say we get to the America of 1814, 1815, you know, the sort of the mid-1800s. How different a place is it from earlier?
Territorially, I think it's different because of the fact that suddenly the boundaries are not the Appalachians with a few states like Kentucky and Tennessee stuck out there on the frontier. The boundaries of statehood and settlement by 1820 really had become the Mississippi River. I mean, it takes Wisconsin a little while to become a state, but the boundaries of settlement and the political boundaries really of statehood have been pushed to the Mississippi. I think that from a world standpoint, in terms of the United States thinking about its international role, it's the story I already told about John Quincy Adams and the Monroe Doctrine suddenly being enunciated after the war within a decade and saying, you know, look, we're going to control the United States are going to control the affairs of North America. And I guess the third piece then of what America looks like after the War of 1812 is that there's this huge resurgence in trade. And the United States really begins to trade not only more globally, but also within different parts of the country and starts to set up an economic resurgence.
Well, there we must leave it because we're here at the end of the time. But, of course, if people want to read more, you should look for the book that we've mentioned. It is 1812, The War That Forged a Nation, published by HarperCollins, by our guest Walter Borneman. And thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, first broadcast on October 25th last year. Programming here on AM 580 made possible by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Programs also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Come